Welcome to the presentation, Lessons from Victims of Crime. It's put together by Betty Chan, Ben Edwards, Peter Hardy and Andrew Knighty. Just a few things. The presentation will run for about 30 minutes and there'll be some time for questions at the end. And also if I could remind you to fill in your feedback presenter forms. So Betty, Peter, Ben and Andrew are experienced actuaries from PwC in Sydney. They help clients with a range of issues in accident compensation and general insurance space, such as pricing, reserving, portfolio monitoring and capital management. More recently, they have applied these skills to victims' compensation, last year helping the New South Wales Government redesign the New South Wales Victims' Compensation Fund. Over to you.
Good evening. A woman is being questioned by police over the fifth suspected murder in Perth this week. Police are hunting the man who flagged down a car and then launched a frenzied attack on the two men inside. One needed surgery for 8 stab wounds.
Police are still searching for a suspect on the run following this daring daylight armed robbery involving a chainsaw in Sydney's eastern suburbs.
A man has been stabbed to death in Ambervale following what police believe was a neighbourly dispute.
A Perth taxi driver has been bashed and his car stolen during an argument over a cigarette.
It is now well known that the sexual abuse of children has been widespread in the Australian community. However, the full range of institutions in which it has occurred is not generally understood.
The Royal Commission will hold 4 public hearings before the end of 2013.
Okay, so violent crimes can have a devastating impact on both the victims and also their families. About 10 years ago, I had an accident, a surfing accident, broke my neck and was in the North Sydney spinal ward for a time, but I was quite lucky. I was able to walk out of there. When I was there, there was a young man about my age who went in there and he was never going to walk again. And effectively, he'd been, the victim of a violent crime. He'd been beaten and thrown over an escarpment, basically left for dead. And at that time, I remember thinking about what sort of supports would be available for that person. I mean, if we think about some of the more accident compensation schemes that are around, there are defined benefits and structures in place. And I suppose what we want to talk to you about today is some of those learnings from that. But fast forward 8 years into the future, we were asked to review the New South Wales Victims Compensation Fund. At that time when we were asked to do the review, there was significant numbers of backlogs in the system and also increasing demand for services and also limited funding for these schemes. We put together a report which only recently has been enacted through legislation and is a publicly available report if people are interested in finding out more information. So following from that, our objective today is really to increase the awareness of victim schemes. And secondly, we believe there's a lot that some of the injury and accident compensation schemes around Australia can learn from some of the lessons we've sort of come to with these victim schemes.
So to provide you with a bit of context, as part of our New South Wales scheme review, we spoke to many of the stakeholders, such as New South Wales Victim Services, Legal Aid and some victim advocacy groups. We also did some victim surveys where we sent out over 1,000 surveys to victims and we did some literature reviews. And see on the graph here, that's the number of reported violent crimes by offence type and that data is from the New South Wales Bureau of Crime Research and Statistics. And it's broken down into different types of violent crimes. So I'll just quickly go through the different types of violent crimes and some key characteristics of each group. So firstly, we have assault. That commonly happens for young males. And immediately after the incident, what they really require is medical and dental treatment. For sexual assault, the literature review showed us that it mainly happened to women and girls. And around 70% of the time, the victim knew the offender. Couldn't be a family member, a friend, a trusted adult, or someone in their school or workplace. And having those relationships creates difficulties for them to report these incidents to police. For victims of sexual assault, the things they need are counselling throughout different points of their life, and also medical treatment for the injuries they've sustained. And they may also need some increases in safety measures, so things such as panic alarms and just extra padlocks in their home. For domestic violence, what we know of domestic violence is it's not a once-off incident and it's not limited to physical violence. So often domestic violence is about power and control, and for the offender, often it starts off with intimidations, threats, which escalate into verbal violence and verbal abuse, and which then escalates into physical violence. And we know this occurs over a prolonged period of time. And because of that relationship between the victim and the offender, it actually creates a lot of difficulties for them to report out of fear and out of fear of safety for them and their children. The immediate needs that a victim of domestic violence require is police assistance, medical treatment, but most importantly, relocation to for them to be out of harm's way and into a safe location. And lastly, for families of victims of homicide, the assistance they require often is funeral costs and also assistance with crime scene cleanup. And of course, for families of homicide victims, it's a severe and profound traumatic event, and they'll require counselling as well.
So it's important to understand that not all victims, all victims have quite unique circumstances. And the circumstances of each victim really differs from the next. And it goes to say that their needs can be quite different. Now what this chart's showing is four key areas that we found that victims need support in. Financial, health and rehabilitation, human services and justice. Now, not every victim needs support or wants support, and not every victim will use all of these different areas of support. They might use different parts of it. But that said, there's some quite common themes when you look at particular cases of violent crime. So if you consider a hypothetical scenario, and we consider a wife who is a domestic violence victim who has an abusive husband. Now, after an episode of violence, she may well go to a local GP for some stitches. She may then go to Medicare and have to deal with Medicare to get a refund from that. She may decide to report the crime to police, in which case she has to deal with police. She may decide to move away from the violence and may need to seek housing and accommodation from Department of New South Wales Housing, for example. Up until that point, she's been heavily dependent on a partner for income, and she may need to go to Centrelink to get some support there. But she also may be aware that the victim schemes do help with relocation costs, for example, to help her get away from violence and fund things like new fridges or a new couch so a family can move across in relative comfort. Now, you compare that to someone who's a victim of child sexual assault, they're more likely to need counselling in the first instance to help them deal with the trauma, but they're also going to need help going through the court process and finding out when they need to appear for court hearings to give evidence and things like that. So these are very different needs physically, financially and psychologically. And whereas the victim of sexual assault is more likely to need help through the justice areas, the victim of domestic violence is going to need help through those family and community type areas. Now victim schemes tend to operate in and around all of these different areas. Traditionally they've had a greater focus in the financial areas and providing lump sum compensation for the financial areas. But more recently a couple of schemes have moved across to a needs-based type service where they are helping victims navigate through all of these different areas and trying to help fill in some of the gaps that are between the areas, but still having that financial focus as well.
So in Australia, there's a separate victim scheme in each state or territory. We've categorised these into financial assistance-based schemes and schemes which focus more on lump sum compensation. The New South Wales, Victoria and Queensland schemes have actually recently shifted from a lump sum based scheme to a financial assistance based scheme. And in the case of the New South Wales scheme, our review found that the old scheme wasn't able to provide the timely support that victims needed, as there were large backlogs which had developed and claims were getting paid years after they were getting reported. So through our surveys, we found that this timely support and care was really important to the victims. So the financial assistance-based schemes, they focus on providing timely care and financial assistance to cover expenses So these expenses would include things like counselling, medical expenses, loss of earnings, relocation or upgrading security. However, these schemes also provide a relatively smaller lump sum payment. So this lump sum is provided more as a recognition payment, a symbolic gesture, to acknowledge that the claimant has been a victim of a violent crime. We found that this acknowledgement was quite important to victims, as they might have had the feeling that people don't believe them, or they might be making things up, or they might have been told by the offender that it's their fault that they're suffering this crime, especially if they were a child victim. And so this lump sum helps to acknowledge the fact that they were a victim, and also provides them with closure and helps them to move on from the crime. The lump sum based schemes usually involve a discretionary lump sum amount being paid, and this amount would include, it's intended to include amounts for things like pain and suffering, loss of enjoyment of life, loss of income, and also medical and treatment expenses. The exception here is the Northern Territory scheme, where the amount paid is based on a schedule of compensable injuries. However, these lump sum based schemes are still not intended to provide full compensation. A key feature of all these schemes is that we don't need the offender to be convicted of a crime before an amount is paid to the victim. So we only need to establish that a violent crime occurred on the balance of probabilities. So in other words, it's more likely than not that a crime did occur. I'll talk a bit about the funding of these victim schemes. So finding an appropriate funding source is one of the major challenges for victim schemes. Funding is quite modest compared to other personal injury schemes, with approximately $9 per capita of funding for most of the schemes around Australia. The funding comes from three main sources. The first source is from Treasury. The second is from restitution from convicted offenders. So that basically means asking the convicted offender to pay for the amounts being paid to the victim that they committed the crime against. And the third source comes from things like court fine levies, other fines and proceeds of crime. Treasury's funding is the main source of funding for victim schemes. However, there is an issue with Treasury funding in that it's usually a fixed amount and it's not linked to offence rates or utilisation of these victim schemes. So this could lead to the development of backlogs if utilisation increases, and that was what we saw in the New South Wales in the old scheme. Restitution from convicted offenders in principle sounds like a good idea, as it's linking the causes of the crimes with the funding. However, in practice, this can be difficult because the offenders might have a low capacity to pay. They might be from lower socioeconomic backgrounds, or they might not be convicted of the crime, or they can't be located. And there's also a fear of retaliation from the victim, and so victims often don't want to pursue restitution against their offenders. Court levies, fines and proceeds of crime also holds an intuitive appeal because the funding source is linked to the offenders of crime. However, apart from in South Australia, the use of these sources is quite limited. In particular, proceeds of crime aren't used widely at the moment in terms of funding victim schemes, and we think that this could potentially be a good source of source of funding for these schemes in the future. Yeah. Oh, did you have a question?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's the money that you get from, for example, confiscating illegally, like confiscating drugs so for drug dealers, they might have a lot of money that they earn from, selling drugs and so on. And so when they're caught, then you take all their money, and that would be like proceeds of crime. So here we've also listed alcohol taxes. Now, alcohol taxes aren't currently being used. However, and this is also quite a political issue, but there is quite a lot of literature surrounding alcohol, or the link between violence and alcohol. So we think that this is another potential source of funding that could help to fund these victim schemes.
So there are some barriers that victim schemes need to deal with in order to deliver the types of services that they want to deal with. Some of them affect claims lodgement and scheme utilisation, and some affect victims' welfare. So we start with scheme utilisation. When we think about injury schemes more generally, it's quite rare where we can think of a circumstance where an individual wouldn't lodge a claim against the scheme if they're injured. By comparison, only around 6 to 10% of victims of crime actually lodge claims with victim schemes. Now, there's a couple of reasons for this. Firstly, all of these schemes have some form of time limits in place to prevent claims that report after a certain period. I think it's around 3 years, roughly, on average for most of them, with some exceptions given. Now, a lot of these claims have reporting periods that in some ways mirror latent claims, so they can take decades to emerge, particularly childhood sexual assault claims. So time limits actually prevent some claims coming through in the first instance. The other difficulty is victims tend to have a relationship with the offender with the offender. Quite often this is a trusted family member or someone that's in a position of power over them. And actually reporting the offender to the police and to a scheme is quite confronting and challenging for these people. There's certain subgroups within Australian society as well that might be less likely to report the claim to police. In certain Indigenous and ethnic communities, there can be a mistrust of police, and that prevents claims being lodged. Now, I put victims advocacy groups there, but they're not a barrier. They're actually an enabler that are helping to overcome some of this. They will sit down with victims of crime and help them through lodging their claim and overcoming some of the challenges that they face, in particular with their offender, to lodge a claim. More topical note, the video that we showed earlier showed some brief footage on the Royal Commission into Institutional Childhood Sexual Assault, which is ongoing at the moment. And that's expected to unearth many cases of child sexual assault over the past many decades. And hopefully that will help break down some of the barriers. But you may well see a lot of claims lodged in these schemes over the coming years as that starts to happen. In terms of the barriers that prevent schemes from improving victims' welfare. One of the challenges for victims is actually affirming that they are a victim of violent crime. And part of the healing process is them understanding that and believing that. When you have a scheme that has an adversarial process around questioning and scrutinising claims, it can actually be quite harmful to the victim and undoes some of the healing that happens. Immediate delivery of services is critical, particularly where a victim is at risk of further violence occurring. And that can be hindered by lengthy claims processing. We've talked a bit about backlogs of funding, which can happen. But also if there's court or tribunal backlogs, this can also slow things down. I talked a little bit earlier about navigating all the different services. Having done a bit of work in this area, I find it incredibly challenging to understand all the different service providers that are out there dealing with victims of violent crime. And you can imagine if you were someone that's been through a violent act and having to navigate through each of those things, it's very challenging, confronting, and a lot of the time overwhelming. Access in regional areas to services is a challenge for not just victims of violent crime, but for all types of government services. But you can imagine trying to provide a counsellor to meet someone's specific needs in a remote area, and finding that counsellor and finding them in is not only expensive, but also finding the right person can be quite difficult.
So to date, we've sort of the discussions highlighted some of the complexities and also the unique circumstances around victims of violent crimes, and also the wide range of supports that are required. At this stage, I think it's useful to pause and actually compare and contrast some of the characteristics of these types of victim support schemes with more traditional injury schemes and specifically accident compensation schemes. If we think about the trigger of the injury, firstly, most accident compensation schemes, as the name suggests, is triggered on an accident, a motor vehicle accident or a workplace incident, and that's really an insurable risk. If we think about violent crimes, though, a lot of those are premeditated acts of violence, And so it's difficult to actually have an insurability of those sort of risks, and that obviously has some implications for funding and so forth. Secondly, if we think about the demographics of victims of violent crime, typically they're of a lower socioeconomic background, and that really has some key implications for the services that are actually provided under these schemes. For example, the importance of translator requirements so that they're able to communicate effectively, and also the case coordination type roles, so that they're helped to navigate the complex degree of support services that are around. And we think there's actually some applicability of some of this to other accident compensation schemes as well, so both those sort of roles. Thirdly, if we think about the type of injuries that are sustained, so there obviously is a lot of physical injuries sustained by victims of violent crimes, but in nearly all cases there's a high level of psychological sort of need and psychological injury. And it was interesting to hear Paul O'Connor sort of talking a lot about some of the trends in accident compensation schemes at the moment. And these are the types of problems that the victim schemes are dealing with on a daily basis. So the importance of counselling and getting counselling up front and when required can often be an effective and a cheap way to improve claimant outcomes. And finally, in terms of advocacy and support groups, if you think about balancing the competing interests of the different stakeholders and players within environments, both in accident compensation schemes and victim schemes, in other injury schemes you might have industry groups and unions sort of lobbying for certain outcomes. That's very much the case also within victim schemes, where there's very varied support groups specific to the types of violence potentially, or also the claimant demographics.
So, having heard about the needs of the victims, the supports available, and the barriers to access this support, one of the key things we've learned is that support needs to be flexible, to be tailored to the victim's individual circumstances. And so this is the model of support we've come up with. So the two foundations of this benefit model is firstly case coordination and secondly counselling. So a consistent theme when we were speaking with the stakeholders and through the victim surveys was that counselling is very important, and that it needed to be available to different for victims at different points in their life. And because counselling helps to deal with the psychological trauma and it helps the victims get back on their feet and to be able to partake in society again. Another consistent thing we heard was the difficulties victims had in navigating all the support services that were available. And so we proposed for them to have a case coordinator as a single point of contact that they could tap into in order to access all the different services from many government and non-government agencies. Because if you consider a victim, they've already been traumatised by an event. How difficult would it be for them to have to call up five different agencies just to get some short-term accommodation? And because of that difficulty, we think a case coordinator is very important. And now to, I guess, talk about the meat inside the sandwich for the financial needs, I want to take you guys through an example of a domestic violence victim. So we know that early intervention gets the best outcomes. So immediately after an event for a domestic violence victim, they'll need police assistance and they'll need relocation to a safe environment for them and their children, and also medical treatment. And after that point, I spoke about earlier how for a domestic violence victim, often their offending partner is the breadwinner in the family. They're the source of income. Once having left the violent home, then they would actually need some support for living expenses. And we want to recognise their need for that particular circumstance. So they might need, as Ben said, you know, new fridges, a new couch for their new home. They might need childcare for the children while the victim works. And so in the medium term, they might need some support, and our benefit model allows for that flexibility if needed. One thing unique to victims' compensation is the idea of a recognition payment. If you consider for a domestic violence victim, she would have been told constantly by the offending partner that the abuse that was happening to her was her fault. She would have lived in fear and shame throughout, thinking it was her fault, and she would have no financial control over her life. And so it's from this backdrop that makes the provision of a recognition payment really powerful and therapeutic. I guess the recognition payment is tangible proof that their story has been believed, and it empowers the victim by giving them financial control over their lives, often for the first time in a long time. And so the recognition payment helps to give victim closure to a violent chapter of their lives. And for a domestic violence victim, it also helps them to not go back to the situation of violence, because they have the financial means now to be able to stand on their feet and live in a safe environment.
So we wanted to sort of close there and say we were actually quite excited that the name change of the seminar from Accident Compensation Scheme to the Injury Scheme Seminar, because what it did, it provided a forum for us to sort of talk a bit more broadly about other types of injury schemes, such as the victims of violent crime sort of schemes. Our paper should be available on the website, and it contains a lot more information than what we've gone through sort of today. But at the end of the day, what we wanted to present today was basically, firstly, to increase the awareness of these types of schemes to people, but secondly, that there's actually a lot of lessons that can be learned from schemes such as the victims' compensation schemes around Australia and support schemes, and hopefully we've presented a few of those today. So I'll open it up now for some discussion and questions.
Does anyone have any questions? And if so, I'll bring the microphone to you. I have a question for you. It's around funding. You said proceeds of crime are not used extensively at present, but you recommended that as a potential new source. Why hasn't there been a sort of an investigation of that source in the past?
I think it's fair to say that there has been, but I think it's just one of those things that's actually quite political and quite difficult. My understanding is, and I'm not an expert in all the jurisdictions around Australia, but certainly in New South Wales, that they had investigated using proceeds of crime. But at the end of the day, basically the proceeds of crime goes into general revenue, and again, so it's treated as, and you see from the slides that general revenue is the main source of funding for these sort of schemes. So despite the fact that there's that link between the two, it's just that it's hard to actually, I suppose, allocate it to specific purposes.
Hi, I have a question around funding as well. In one of your slides, you mentioned that the average funding is $9 per capita. Is that based on the lump sums model, or is it, or do we know how much the funding is going to change with the new benefit design?
I'm not across all the states, but the funding, for example, in New South Wales is a fixed amount, and changing the benefit design had no effect on the funding. They're sort of separate issues. You're looking at how do you restructure within the means of the funds that you've got available. So the funding stayed the same as New South Wales switched from the old lump sum system to the new needs-based system. Does that get at your question?
Yeah. Oh.
Hi, I'm just curious. You said that just a very small lump sum is paid in some states as recognition, as like a recognition payment. How small are we talking about?
I guess it could be around $5,000. Depends on what type of crime it is. So some crimes would get up to, let's say, $20,000. But I think in general it's kind of around those kind of amounts.
Yeah, hi. Most traditional schemes, well, not that this isn't one, they have three general objectives, where one is prevention, one is treatment, and the third one is return to work. So in this scheme, I think the focus seems to be more on the treatment and, I guess, returning people to, I guess, normal lives. To what extent do they get involved in, say, the prevention side? What recommendations do they make, that sort of thing?
I think the funding of the schemes is really such that it's difficult to do a lot against this, I think. And that, to be fair, there's a lot of advocacy groups out there which, I suppose, attempts to sort of promote the prevention of these types of things. So, for instance, there's a number of groups which are specific to, say, sexual assault sort of crimes. There's ones that's specific to Indigenous communities as well, and a lot of legal firms that provide support from that perspective. So there is actually, a focus on that sort of thing. One of the ideas we bring out in our paper is that, to the extent that you can actually bring a bit more awareness of these types of things, that if there are violent crimes which are shown within, say, newspapers, have a hotline number at the bottom so that people are aware that sort of support is actually around there. But, I mean, from my experience, I wouldn't necessarily know where to go if I was the victim of a violent crime. And I think that's one of the barriers that Ben was sort of talking about trying to promote the prevention of these things is awareness of the issues. I mean, if we think about the Commission into Child Sexual Assault and so forth, I think that's bringing a lot of these things to the fore, and hopefully there's a preventative side to the increasing awareness of the types of crimes out there.
Any more questions? I just have one final question. With the institutional, or the Commission into the Institutional failings in terms of child sexual abuse, it's obviously going to place quite a heavy demand on these sort of services and benefits. Has there been any sort of thought given to that impact that you're aware of at present?
Our paper sort of highlights some of the potential issues that could come about as a result of, greater utilisation. As we said earlier, it's probably only 6 to 8% of crimes actually want to go forward, and there's a lot of reasons why that actually happens as well. I mean, some people don't want to go forward and do that because they need to relive the crime to access some of the services and so forth. So. But from our perspective, actually being aware of what the trends are within the different victim schemes is quite important. And that was something that came out in the New South Wales review, was that not necessarily the prevalence of the number of crimes that was occurring was increasing, but certainly the utilisation, crimes that maybe occurred 20 to 30 years ago, not too dissimilar to latent claims sort of events like asbestos and so forth, so actually being aware of where that is. And certainly the Royal High Commission into Child Sexual Abuse is an example where those utilisation amounts could rise quite significantly.
Okay, please join me in thanking Ben, Peter, Betty and Andrew.